Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our friend and neighbor, Chapel Hill's own William Ferris, has spent a lifetime collecting, celebrating the voices of the entire South. And he's recorded them sound-wise with movies, and he's combined his lifetime of interviewing important writers and artists in the South to his new book, published by UNC Press, The Storied South. And Bill Ferris, thanks for taking time to come chat with us about your book.
It's a pleasure to be here.
This is an incredible, I think, event in publications to have a book which is accompanied by a CD of the interviews that are the basis of the book, and then DVD with many video recordings of these interviews of these people. And I'd like to talk about that later, but first of all, tell us about what's in the book and what it is.
Well, the book really tracks my love for and interest in the American South. And over the last 40 years, the people who were my heroes and heroines whose work inspired my own, I was able to meet these people along the way, and they graciously invited me in and interviewed. I did interviews, photographs, and films with them. And this was before a field that today we call Southern Studies existed. These were the building blocks of what is so closely associated with UNC, the study of the South. And I thought a few years ago it would be interesting to connect the dots of all these people and their lives in a single work. And so this book does that, and it allows you not only to read their interviews, but to hear their voices and to see moving pictures of many of them. Eudora Welty, Robert Penn Warren.
Well, Eudora Welty, there's this wonderful photograph that you took of Eudora driving the car that's on the cover. So reminisce a little bit about your contacts with Eudora Welty, both from the standpoint of the substance that it gives to the book, and also for us, I don't want to say she was the beginning of a journey, but she was the beginning of a piece of your journey with established writers. How did all that happen?
Well, it goes back really to before I was born. Her parents and my grandparents lived near each other in Jackson. And
this is in Mississippi.
In Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And when I was a young child on the farm where I grew up, Eudora and some of her friends who were artists came and picnicked and spent a day doing watercolors of the landscape and sharing the outdoors. And after they left, my mother told me, one day you'll know the name of one of these people who is a famous writer named Eudora Welty. And years later at Davidson College, I invited Eudora to be our speaker of the year. And to my amazement, she came. And when the English faculty asked Miss Welty, why did you agree to come here for this talk? She said, well, Bill Ferris invited me, and I know his family and felt I just had to come. So
it made you into a big man on campus.
My stock went through the roof.
Well, was this a key in terms of your saying, well, if I can do this, I can see other people and get to know other people as well?
Yes, and Eudora was an inspiration. I began reading her work in high school, her dramatic monologues like Why I Live at the P.O. I began writing short stories at Davidson inspired by her, and I later saw her photography when I was doing my field work in folklore, and that inspired me to do similar kinds of black and white portraits of people and landscapes. And then I became really a friend of hers, and we saw each other. She came to my classes at Yale and to the University of Mississippi, and I would always visit her when I went back home and take her a bottle of Maker's Mark, and we would sit around and talk. But she is the person in the book that I knew longest and best. And that is why I open the book. She's the first of 26 people, writers, scholars, musicians, photographers, and painters who were my great inspiration.
Bill, what is the focusing on Eudora Welty as, I don't want to call her the lead character in your book, but the introductory character. What is it now, many years later, that she tells us that that is worth preserving and putting in your book? What are the messages that your readers, watchers, and listeners are going to get from the contact with Eudora Welty?
Well, we begin with the given that she is one of the great American writers of fiction, novels, short stories, nonfiction, photography. But this interview takes you behind the scenes into her imagination, what it was like to travel around Mississippi photographing and then to translate stories and images into fiction. It also is important because she reflects on why a region like the South at her particular time produced so many writers, Faulkner, Richard Wright, Thomas Wolfe, Tennessee Williams. Other regions like New England and the West had their periods. But this is a thoughtful, very intimate access to Eudora. She talks about her first meeting with William Faulkner when he took her sailing for a day on a lake, and they never spoke to each other.
No, wait. Now they're in the sailboat and never talk.
They simply sat there and drifted around the lake, never speaking. And she understood that, as did he, as a communication that didn't require words. But these are moments in Eudora's life that we can enter in a very private way. And all of these interviews are private. It's like...
Well, let me I'm sorry just to focus on Eudora. We'll get to some of the many other Southern artists and writers that you deal with. But when you conducted the interview, the question is, what were you seeking? And sort of the comment on that question is, was it to get a moment in time or a deep wisdom? Did you have a list of questions that you wanted her to answer, or did you just want to have a good conversation with her about what she was worried about today? How did all that go?
I just wanted access to her imagination and her mind with a tape recorder running. And I let her lead me where she wanted to go, and I would ask questions periodically. I was curious about her photography. Mm. I was curious about her relationship with New York City, her relationship to artists and other writers like Robert Penn Warren, and to black writers like Alice Walker and Margaret Walker, who are also in the book. But I really let her ramble, and I interviewed her repeatedly. So this narrative in the book is a merging of all of those often unexpected comments, like she subscribed to the Mississippi Farm Bulletin, and she would correspond with these women in rural Mississippi who would send her seeds of various flowers and plants, and they would have these exchanges, and sometimes the women would be upset and say, I can't possibly go out and dig these plants at this time of the year. How would you presume to ask? But Eudora had this wonderfully open relationship from everyone, from great writers like Robert Penn Warren and Ralph Ellison to people in rural Mississippi whom she'd never met, but she respected and embraced them as part of a world that, as a writer, she was trying to understand and celebrate.
Did you learn things from her in these interviews that have been useful and or meaningful in your own life?
I did. I am a failed writer. I started at Davidson with aspirations of being a writer, and then I realized I really am not good enough. So I found myself moving in another direction as a folklorist to record the voices that Eudora wrote about. And it's always been my interest, and I teach a course on this, Southern Literature and the Oral Tradition, looking at how the folklore of a region, be it the South or Ireland or Nigeria, shapes the writers, and how a writer like Eudora Welty listens for stories and for the quality of voice that we hear in and read in her short stories and novels. So I wanted her to talk about that process, which is a very personal, private world, a workshop inside the writer's imagination. And as she and others say, they write about the literary, imaginative region rather than the geographic region, but those are connected. And in this interview, she talks about that, the sense of place, which she was fond of writing about, is a powerful vehicle in her fiction. And I really wanted her, and I repeatedly would come about different ways in asking her about that. And she was very thoughtful and incredibly eloquent in her voice in this interview. Wow.
We're visiting with William Farish. We're talking about his new book, The Storied South, which is a collection of his interviews, assembled interviews, both on paper. He's also got them on DVD and on CD, so you can listen and or watch to the conversations with these important Southerners. He and I'll be right back to talk about some of the other people that he features. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is William Farish, professor of history and associate director of the Center for the Study of American South, and the author, not the editor, compiler, author of a wonderful book, CD, DVD, photographs that deal with his interaction with more than 26 important representatives of the South. We've been talking about Eudora Welty, and you mentioned that she had an interest and a connection, even in the segregated South, with African-American writers. And Alice Walker, I think you mentioned, as one of her friends and also a subject of your book. And so tell us a little bit about Alice Walker, how you happened to get in touch with her, and what you learned from her.
Well, in 1970, I began teaching for the first time at Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi. And Alice Walker and her husband, Mel Leventhal, lived in Jackson, and we quickly met them.
Were you living on the same street, or were you nearby, or what was
No, we lived in different areas, but if you taught in a black school, you referred to that world as being behind the stockade.
Oh, now explain that. Explain that.
Well, for example, my wife at the time and I were looking for a place to live in Jackson. We both taught at Jackson State, and we would, in a white neighborhood, nice homes, people would show them to us, and they would say, now, of course, you understand, the neighbors are not going to be comfortable if you have black friends come to visit you. We don't care, but the neighbors.
Somebody else might care.
And so we said, well, we are not going to live here under those conditions. So we ended up living in a black neighborhood, Guine Street, two doors down from Margaret Walker Alexander, a black writer with whom I taught, and two doors down the other way from the home of Medgar Evers, where he was assassinated. There, we had a lovely home, and we could have anyone come see us that we wished.
Well, you sort of stuck out, though. You're in a black neighborhood, and you're probably the only white folks on the street.
Yes. But being behind the stockade, if you were teaching in a black school as we were, you very quickly met all of the other teachers at Tougaloo College and people in the community who were involved with literature. And Alice Walker, we quickly met at parties and we became very close friends. Her husband, Mel Leventhal, was a civil rights lawyer in Jackson.
So she was married to a white guy.
She was married.
So there was a cross, there was an openness.
Yes.
That allowed all of you to cross these racial divides that were still there in Jackson.
Yes. And we, as couples, we were very close, and they had just arrived in their family, was Alice's daughter, Rebecca. And so I remember visiting Alice in her home, and in her study, she would sit at her desk. She was finishing her novel, Grange Copeland, and beside her desk was Rebecca in a little cradle. She was doing everything well, but that's how we first met. And I saw Alice and Mel often, and when I moved to Yale, she came there and spoke. Then I brought her to the University of Mississippi for a reading, and more recently, she came here at my invitation and spoke at UNC. So we've been friends really since 1970, and this interview was done when I was in Oxford and
in Mississippi.
In Mississippi,
and when you were at the when you come back to be at the university.
Yes, I was directing the Center for Study of Southern Culture at the University of Mississippi, and we brought Alice there to do a reading and gave her a tour of the Faulkner home, Roanoke, and of the Blues Archive. And in this interview, she says, I dream of being the B.B. King of literature because I admire him so much. He's a deeply beloved person, and that's my sort of dream.
Well, Bill, I'm curious, and you deal with this some, about the relationship between Mississippi— well, between and among African American authors and William Faulkner, mm-hmm. whose writing projects the life of a segregated and racist South, and yet African American, many African American authors seem to admire him and adopt him as being kind of their godfather. Maybe I'm overstating that, but how does that work? How do you explain that?
Well, the way to explain it is, I think it was Flannery O'Connor, when asked about Faulkner, said, when the Dixie Limited comes down the tracks, you get out of the way. Anyone, black or white, who reads Faulkner is overwhelmed by the power of language and how he uses it. Ernest Gaines, the author of the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, who is in my book, keeps over his desk a portrait of William Faulkner. Faulkner, for him and for many black writers, including Ralph Ellison, is a force to be reckoned with. Race is really not the issue. The issue is that he is probably the greatest of all writers in the English language. There's
Whoa!
I'm going to continue.
No, whoa! This is great. So, move aside Shakespeare. Move aside Thomas Wolfe.
I want to say more has been written on Faulkner than on William Shakespeare.
No.
I found that hard to believe, but
Wait! How can you check this? I mean,
it's checkable. But you have a writer of fiction, you know, many writers like Twain has one, maybe two great novels, Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer. Moby Dick. We think of great writers, The Invisible Man. In Faulkner's case, there are at least a dozen incredibly important novels. And he also created this whole idea of maps, the map of Yaknapatawpha County and the mythic Jefferson County seat, that became a template for 20th century writers who looked at sense of place. And Faulkner was inspired by James Joyce, who did the same thing with Dublin. But every writer, not only black and white, but every modern writer goes back to Faulkner to understand what the modern writer can and should be, whether they're living in another country and writing a different language or in the American South.
Well, this is startling. I'm going to get you. I'm going to study up and mm-hmm. get you back to talk even more about Faulkner, who's unfortunately not a part of the book, except that so many of the artists and or primarily the writers follow your lead and say that they were inspired or influenced in some respect.
Well, when I got the book back before it was published with its index, I was stunned to see that the largest list of references to a person in the book was not one of the interviewees. It was William Faulkner, because virtually every person, not only the writers, but the painters, the photographers, they all talk about Faulkner and how he shaped their lives in deep ways as artists and as writers.
Wow. We're visiting with William Ferris. We're talking about his new book, The Storied South. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with William Ferris. Bill is our neighbor here in Chapel Hill. And Bill, you and I both are, we still have to say we're sort of new. But I mean, now you've been here
12 years.
Longer than maybe you've been most places. And Chapel Hill has benefited incredibly by your work, both as a teacher, researcher, and to help the development of the Center for the Study of American South. We're grateful to you.
Thank you.
And now grateful to you for the assembly of, I stutter when I start to talk about all of the things that are involved in your book, but it's basically a collection of the voices of Southern writers and artists, and we're talking mostly about writers. We talked about, last about William Faulkner, who's not one of the subjects, but is mentioned throughout the book by people like Alice Walker and Eudora Welty. One of the African-American authors who concedes and celebrates a debt to Faulkner is Ernest Gaines. And any serious student of Southern literature knows who Ernest Gaines is. I have to confess, I didn't until I met Wiley Cash, mm-hmm. Who's, you know, the explosion on the scene of the North Carolina writers, who says that he had to go to Louisiana and study with Ernest Gaines in order to be able to write about North Carolina, mm-hmm. and is a great admirer of Gaines. So Gaines is one of the subjects. Tell us more about Gaines and why he's important.
Well, Ernest Gaines comes from the very deep, deep South in Louisiana, in the Creole, Cajun areas. He writes about, for me, the most poignant worlds in which black and white characters fall in love, and it's like a Romeo-Juliet scenario in which the relationship of love makes them challenge racial segregation and the taboos of Jim Crow. And it's always a tragic ending. But he is able to create in the most moving, powerful ways a love of deep affection between a male and female who are reaching across the racial divide. And he also reaches deeply into the language of his people there.
What is he's a black African-American mm-hmm. in Cajun country.
Right.
And so you've got a whole, in that part of Louisiana, you've got a complex social yes. order, I guess, that is a little bit different from the way it is in the rest of the South.
Yes, this is Francophone Louisiana. It's English is spoken there, but there are also families who still...
So black and white families who are speaking
Black French. And white often can speak both French and English. So you have that layer. You have the Catholic Church as the dominant religion in many of those areas. It's a very complex and different world from much of the South that we think of. Gaines left his home early and moved to California, grew up there, and then began to write about the stories of his people. And he created over several years the character of Miss Jane Pittman, and melding the voices of the elders whom he remembered as a child. And by drawing on those voices and their stories, he created this epic, a century of living that this black woman relates in her autobiography that has often been misunderstood and considered an actual
nonfiction.
Mm-hmm. Because
it's sort of like Allen Gurganus's Confederate Widow.
Exactly. But Ernest Gaines is a... He's a dear friend whom I've known, and I had him speak to students when I was at Yale, and we honored him at the National Endowment for the Humanities when I was there. With our
Now I interrupt you. There's no way to introduce you and cover everything, but you, when you were there, you were running the place. You were in charge.
Serving as chairman under President Clinton, and we had the annual presidentially bestowed Humanities Medal that we would give to a few distinct people. Bill Friday received it, Jacqueline Dowd Hall, and Ernest Gaines. And then my wife Marcy and I visited Ernie and his wife Diane a few years ago in their beautiful home in Louisiana. And he has moved. This is land that his ancestors farmed as slaves. He has moved the little church / school room onto his property and restored it as a museum. He's restored the family cemetery. And we had an amazing 2 days talking about those worlds. And then recently, UNC awarded him an honorary degree, and we had brunch together in our home. So our lives have been closely linked over the years, and I teach his work every spring in my class, and his voice, really all the voices in this book on tape, are very powerful and very different in their sound. Ernest Gaines is a soft-spoken, gentle voice. And when he reads his fiction, it's quite powerful and quite moving.
Again, if you joined us late, Bill Ferris is talking about his book, The Storied South, and it is a compilation of his interviews and connective links, photographs, audio and video files of his conversations with these folks. We're talking now about Ernest Gaines. You mentioned that he had left Louisiana as a youngster and gone to California. Our friend John Reed says that you can't appreciate where you came from unless you leave, and I wonder if that happened to him, and if it happened to you when you left the South too.
Yes, I think it happens to every Southerner. Robert Penn Warren once told me that a fish never thinks about water until he's out of it. And when a Southerner leaves the South and crosses what we call the iced tea and grits line, and tea then is served hot and grits with cream and sugar, you realize you've moved into a different world, that you are a different person because of your roots as a Southerner. And both white and black Southerners understand that. And certainly for Ernest Gaines, when he moved to Vallejo, California, it was a shocking change. And his fiction is a way of coming to terms with being a black Southerner in San Francisco and writing about your roots in rural Louisiana.
We're visiting with Bill Ferris. We're talking about his book, The Storied South, Voices of Writers and Artists. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're visiting with our neighbor, William Ferris. It's hard to believe that with all of the introductory remarks that I've neglected to do to tell what you've done and where you've been, we're focusing on your book. I hope that's okay.
Absolutely.
And we've talked about some of the several of the 26 people that you feature in the book, both with your, an edited and arranged remembrance of the interviews. Plus, if you don't trust you to have done it right, you can listen to the actual ones on the CD that you provide, or watch it on the DVD that you've got with many of the interviews. Wonderful compilation. One of the important Southern characters that you record is someone which we don't talk about quite as much as we used to, Robert Penn Warren. Tell us about him and why he's in the book and what he taught us.
Well, Robert Penn Warren is the dean of Southern letters. He wrote All the King's Men, arguably the greatest political novel. He was our nation's first poet laureate. He wrote fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and taught much of his life at Yale University, and co-authored with Cleanth Brooks a series of literature textbooks, understanding poetry, understanding fiction, that for roughly 30 to 40 years were the textbooks that every school child in the country learned literature from. He had deep roots in Kentucky, grew up as a child taking care of a grandfather who had fought in the Civil War, listening to those stories, and was a wonderful, warm, generous person who allowed me to sit and to study and learn from him.
What do we learn from him that's important for today?
Well, from Robert Penn Warren, we learn that people can change. His career began at Vanderbilt when he was part of the Fugitives, who wrote a classic book called I'll Take My Stand, saying, I will not become part of this industrialized society. I want to go back to the good old days, the agrarian worlds. But in those worlds—
We think of the Fugitives as being like our Luddites, sort of the—
Well,
we like it the way it was. We don't want to get sucked up and corrupted by the things that are happening in the modern world.
Well, it was a mythic past in which no blacks were present, and certainly that is not the case in actual history. But Robert Penn Warren grew and changed, and later in his life he wrote Who Speaks for the Negro, in which he wanted to reaffirm and reconnect his identity as a Southerner with the civil rights movement. He interviewed Malcolm X, civil rights leaders, and no one in that group at Vanderbilt had anything like that transformation. He was truly alive and changing throughout his long, productive literary career.
So one of the messages that we would get from your book about Warren is he changed, we can change. Is that right, or is there more to it than that?
No, I think that's part of it, that all of these speakers, and Warren certainly included, changed throughout their life. Eudora Welty, after the assassination of Medgar Evers, sat down and said, I know who did it. I can imagine that person. And she wrote a fictional short story that was hauntingly accurate. She changed. They all moved. And this book, for me, was a way of bringing these 26 figures, most of whom never met each other, together at a common table of conversation to let them sit around and talk, and the reader is privileged to kind of move through their worlds and connect in ways that each of them would have loved.
Well, Bill, I'd love to keep talking about your book, and it's rich, and every time you turn the page, there's another surprise. And thanks for sharing those with us. I wish you'd tell us a little bit about your work here on the Chapel Hill campus, mainly with the Center for the Study of the American South. you guys are stirring up things and bringing mm-hmm. things. What's happening, and what do you aspire to for the center to be doing, even in addition to the current plans?
Well, the center essentially is building on over a century of distinguished work. The largest archives on the South are here in the world. The work of Howard Odum and Guy Johnson early in the 20th century created the study of the South as a field. And we at the center are building out in a very public way the access to classes and concerts and lectures. We have an electronic mailing list, and if people are interested, we let them know what's going on. We have Julian Bond coming this fall to give one of our lectures. We also stream those lectures visually on a computer. You can watch the lectures if you're not able to come. We have concerts on the porch.
Well, let me just mention, for those who haven't noticed, right next door to the President's House mm-hmm. on Franklin Street, you've got the most prominent center of the whole university right there, accessible by townspeople on foot. And is there a way that folks in Chapel Hill can enjoy what's going on inside that nice building?
Yes.
People sitting on the porch in rocking chairs. And
they can come just walk in the front door. We have an exhibit at the front on the history of the building, the Love family and the Hutchins family, who are both associated with our work. We have an exhibition of photographs on my book up right now. 45 photographs are on
exhibit. So if somebody can't afford the book, they can come look at your pictures.
That's right.
For free at the center.
There's no charge, and they can bring a sandwich and sit on the porch and just enjoy the beautiful weather and the neighborhood. But that center is a kind of crossroads.
Can I stop? I apologize. I interrupted mm-hmm. you too mm-hmm. much, but for some of us who are not on Franklin Street and don't have a front porch where we can look out and watch the town go by, there are rocking chairs on your porch, and you don't object to people coming and sitting there and enjoying. Am I right about that?
Why they're there. We are the oldest and finest public university in the nation, and those chairs are a symbol of public access to the American South. So anyone who would like to be a part of what we do is welcome to come for events or just to drop in.
Well, Bill, your papers, voluminous. I've heard tales of truckloads of your papers coming to be a part of the Southern Historical Collection. Are you all looking around for other ideas to share with the collection of papers, and what kinds of things have you identified as being candidates to go into the collection for future historians to look at?
Well, as I said, we have the largest archive in the world, and the Southern Historical Collection and the Southern Folklife Collection are where these collections are housed. And we are rapidly building out and gathering collections. The future of the South will have different collections. There will be Hispanic papers. There will be Asian papers. All of the new populations coming to the South will become fair game for the study of our history. But anyone out there who has a family album of photographs, who have a packet of letters, and they don't have to be antebellum. They could be from the 20th or the 21st century. We are documenting life in the South. And everyone says, well, my family are not important. You are important. Wow. As long as you have collections that you have somehow saved, I encourage you, all the listeners, to talk with UNC about setting up an archive to preserve the legacy of your family.
Well, that's a great way to end a conversation about Bill Ferris's book, The Story South, in which he's collected the voices of writers and artists and shared them with us today. Thanks, Dr.
My
Ferris.
My pleasure. Thank you, DG.
Thanks to you for listening. This is DG Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.